Okay, good morning, everybody. All right, good morning. My name is David Nahai. I serve as chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board, and today is Thursday, October 23rd. It is 9:06 a.m., and I'm calling this meeting to order. For people who only want to listen to or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. There is a direct link to the webcast on the meeting agenda posted on our website. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comments through a Zoom meeting platform and in person. For people who want to listen or watch the meeting in Spanish, we have Spanish interpretation services available through the Zoom platform. Instructions are shown on the slide. And could we have one of our Spanish interpreters please explain how to participate in Spanish?
Hi, good morning. It's Leticia with one of the Spanish interpreters. Okay, so we have Spanish interpretation is being provided today. If attendees joining us today would like to listen to today's presentation in Spanish, please go to the interpretation icon in your meeting webinar controls. You will then see the language channels, select Spanish. There's a mute original audio to listen to in the interpreted language only. Vamos a dar las instrucciones ahora en español. Tendremos servicio de interpretación en español. Si alguien está asistiendo, desea escuchar esta presentación en español, busque en su pantalla este icono de interpretación que está llamado por interpretación. Ahora verá los canales de idiomas. Usted puede hacer clic en el español o en el que está llamado como Spanish, que es opcional. Para escuchar solo en español, haga clic en silenciar audio original, en mudar el audio original, que es el en mudar. Y para usar la función de interpretación de idioma, los participantes tienen que descargar la aplicación de Zoom en su escritorio, teléfono inteligente o tableta. Si usted necesita ayuda técnica de interpretación de idioma, usted puede mandar un correo electrónico a lo que es bob@agpvideo.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, please note that for all Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Board meetings, there is no expectation of privacy regarding any communications. Meetings are recorded and names of participants are listed in the Zoom forum. Participation in a recorded meeting will be deemed consent to be recorded. Let's move on to the roll call and the determination of a quorum. Ms. Rowe?
Vice Chair Ashion.
Who's joining remotely, I think.
Present.
Board Member Camacho.
Here.
Board Member Christensen.
Here.
Board Member Mendez.
Here.
Chair Nahai.
Yes.
Roll call completed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So a couple of introductory items. We have a roll call and we have a quorum. So Vice Chair Ashtian has requested to participate remotely in this meeting in accordance with the provisions of the Bagley-Keene Open Meetings Act, specifically Government Code Section 11123.2. Remote participation requires that a quorum of the board members be physically present, which it is, at a single teleconference location that is open, visible, and audible to the public. So, well, wait, I should have asked for the roll call now, but I've already asked for it, so we're done with that. Okay, Vice Chair Ashtian may proceed with remotely participating in this public meeting. Although she need not disclose her precise location, she must disclose whether there are any individuals 18 years or older present in the same room as she is, as well as the general nature of her relationship with those individuals. Further, Government Code Section 11123.2 requires that Vice Chair Ashgian remain on camera for the entire open portion of this public meeting unless there is a poor internet connection or it would be technologically impracticable to do so. If Vice Chair Ashgian needs to turn off her camera during the open portion of the meeting, she must announce her reason for doing so. So I'll ask our lawyers if there are any other legal issues to be disclosed in connection with the remote participation.
No, we just need Vice Chair Ashgian to disclose whether or not there's anyone in the room with her.
Thank you.
No one in the room, thank you.
All right. The next item is the order of the agenda. Agenda items are numbered for identification purposes only and may not necessarily be considered in this order. So I'll ask our executive officer if there are any changes to the order of agenda.
There are no changes to the order, Chair.
Great, thank you. Next, we will move on to board business and reports. The first item is the approval of draft meetings for the July 24th, 1925 meeting. Let me first ask if there are any changes to the draft meetings, any questions by board members regarding the minutes?
Well, not the minutes.
Any? Okay. The minutes that I saw, I thought at the very end of it, they hadn't been signed by the secretary. And also at the very, very, very beginning of the minutes, I think it needs to say that they're the July 24th minutes, the date, at least I didn't see it clearly identified. So
we will make those changes.
Okay, thank you. So with those changes, could I have a motion for approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a move by Board Member Christensen, second by Board Member Mendez. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Did I also hear you, Vice Chair Ashton? Did you vote?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So carried. Let's go on to the next item, which is the approval of the tentative 2026 board schedule. So are there any questions regarding the board schedule, any changes that any board members would like to suggest?
I have a question. You had a question. So all the entire year we're going to be meeting here in L.A.? We're not going to have any roving meetings?
We have been looking for other locations. There just hasn't been a place that can take us in, but the location can change.
Okay.
Unless you want it to just be here.
No, I would suggest at least one in Ventura, and then maybe just polling the board members that live in LA to find out what month is best to go to Ventura.
December.
All right. Well, perhaps for now we can approve what is recommended by staff, with the understanding that at least one meeting will be in Ventura.
Yes.
Yeah?
We'll start looking into it.
Okay. Could we have a motion for approval of the board's schedule?
A motion.
Okay. From Board Member Camacho, a second from Board Member Mendez. All in favor say aye.
Could we do a roll call vote?
I'm sorry?
Could we just go ahead and do a roll call vote?
Oh, a roll call vote? Yes. Of course we can. Yes, we'll do a roll call vote. So we have a motion. We have a second. Let's call the roll.
Vice Chair Ashgian.
Yes, thank you.
Board Member Camacho.
Yes.
Board Member Christensen.
Yes.
Board Member Mendez.
Yes.
Chair Nahai.
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Next item are board member communications. First, we will cover ex parte disclosures by board members to identify any discussions they may have had requiring disclosure pursuant to Government Code Section 11430.40. So I'll go down. Board Member Christensen, any ex parte communications to report?
None.
Board Member Camacho?
None.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes, just one. Partly because I'm a resident of the city of Long Beach. I was contacted by a representative of the Long Beach utilities to just give me the good news that the city conducted a smoke test of their sewer system to see any potential leaks, and which is also part of their climate adaptation plan. And they were just saying that they had positive results and will be sharing with the board in the near future. And they also did mention about a recent Long Beach Post article about the recent rains and stormwater runoff that's coming upstream. And they're working with other the county and local governments and the board to address some of those stormwater issues that are coming upstream into Long Beach.
Great. Thank you. Vice Chair Ashton, any ex parte disclosure?
No, thank you.
And I don't have any. Next item are board member reports. So board members may discuss communications, correspondence, or other items of general interest relating to matters within the board's jurisdiction. So let's start with any board member reports from Board Member Christensen.
None for me.
Board Member Camacho.
Yes, I do have some reports. There has been a lot going on in the Safe Clean Water Program at the Regional Oversight Committee. And one thing, I'm part of the biennial report working group, and we're putting together recommendations over the last 2 years of work at Safe Clean Water. And so we're going to be working towards a final draft, which will come to the whole Regional Oversight Committee on December the 10th. And then at that point, that final draft will be subject to a 30-day review, and we're looking at final approval in probably the February timeframe. And also, I wanted to report out that on November 12th, there is going to be a scientific advisory committee that the Safe Clean Water Program is going to be initiating. And that's going to be on November 12th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Public Works Alhambra office. And hopefully this scientific advisory committee would be convened on a regular basis to provide direction to the Safe Clean Water Program in terms of scientific studies in the future. So one thing that we are looking forward to. And then another thing that I just wanted to bring to staff's attention, that we all know that the initial watershed plans are being developed by County Public Works for the Safe Clean Water Program, and I think that it's going along very well. But I was wondering if we could provide the Public Works staff with 3 years of water quality data by watershed to help complement that report as well. For the interim watershed plans. And so if I could ask staff of that, that would be great to do, maybe in the December or January timeframe.
Sure, we can do that.
Thank you. Thank you. And that's my report.
Thanks so much. Board Member Van, is any report from you?
Sure, just a pending event that I'll be co-hosting with the UC Irvine Climate Collaborative next Tuesday, which is, I believe, the 28th. It's called Under Fire, Protecting Climate Science in Times of Uncertainty, and we're going to have two senior Biden administration officials, including Martha Guzman, who was the U.S. EPA Region 9 Administrator, and also a colleague of ours. She served on the Public Utilities Commission up in Sacramento or San Francisco. And we're also going to have Justin Knighton, who was a deputy administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency. So it's open to the public 4 p.m. next Tuesday. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Vice Chair Ashton, report from you.
Yes, thank you. And again, apologies about not being there in person. I am attending the American Bar Association's Environmental Law Conference today, and there's lots of discussion about water, as you can imagine, so I will report back next month, and also here for the Environmental Law Institute. I'm teaching next week on environmental justice, so apologies for not being there in person, and look forward to seeing everyone in November. Just two items that I wanted to talk about very briefly is to give a thank you, which now seems like forever ago, but in July, myself and board member Mendez went on the same tour that board member Christensen and Chair Nahai went on to see the Eaton Fire area. I wanted to thank Director Pastrea and all of the staff for a really great tour and thorough explanation of the work that's being done in the region, in the recovery, and to thank also Supervisor Barger and her team who joined us for the day and have put in so much effort into the recovery. And then finally, I wanted to just mention that that Chair Nahai and our executive officer attended the chair-vice chair meeting for the state board. And it was very beneficial to hear what's going on in other regions and how we can bring some best practices back to our region and share about the work that we're doing in our region to hopefully help illuminate others around the state. So that's it for me. And thank you again for accommodating me virtually.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for mentioning the chair's meeting. I have one report. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Los Angeles Business Council, where I serve as chair, held its 19th annual sustainability summit at USC. It was just incredibly well attended, and it was so heartening to see the amount of interest that there is in sustainability issues and taking care of our environment. And the focus on climate change and just how engaged people are really in the face of so many voices and efforts in order to erode and derail environmental protections in the country right now. I had the privilege of chairing the panel on resilience. A lot of it was on water, but not exclusively. We also dealt with a lot of energy issues on the panel. We had on the panel Supervisor Horvath, the general manager at LADWP, Janice Quinones was on, the head of the Clean Power Alliance, Ted Bardicky. We had Liz Croson from MWD, and as many of you know, they have a new general manager at MWD, Shivaji Deshmukh, who's going to be an excellent general manager there, and hopefully we'll be able to invite him one day and talk to him here about his vision for MWD. And also we had Jacqueline Mutter from HDR, the private sector, on the panel as well. So the whole day went very well, but for me the main message was that here in California, in Los Angeles, taking care of the environment, the battle against climate change, resilience issues, recovering from the fires, these are things that people truly, truly care about here, and that was such a heartwarming message that came from the summit. So I wanted to report on that. So, all right. Okay, we'll go on. The next item is our executive officer's report. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Board. I have a few updates. The first update is the update on the former 4th Avenue drill under the Equitable Community Revitalization Grant, ECRG. The former 4th Avenue drill site in Arlington Heights in central Los Angeles is being redeveloped into low-income housing by Thomas Saffron and Associates Kingdom Development, Inc. The site cleanup is funded by a $3.4 million ECRG grant from the Department of Toxic Substances Control, DTSC, for ongoing cleanup activities. The site cleanup is estimated to cost approximately $7.6 million. Board Member Camacho, you might recall attending and providing remarks at the groundbreaking ceremony back in June 26th of 2024, so thank you. Since 2020, the site is under the Los Angeles Water Board's oversight. From approximately 1964 through 2019, the site was used for crude oil production, water injection production, storage, and service. After oil production's operations were terminated, the site was also sold to the current property owner for low-income housing. Site investigations indicate that soil and soil vapor were impacted with petroleum hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds, VOCs. To mitigate contamination, the site has had shallow and deep soil excavations, the application of groundwater remediation chemicals, and soil vapor extraction, SVE. Beneath the new building site, a vapor intrusion mitigation system consisting of a vapor barrier and venting pipes were installed. A new 84-unit apartment building with 42 units designated for permanent supportive housing is expected to be ready for occupancy by the end of the year. The property owner has received over 40,000 applications for half of the units, highlighting the significant demand for affordable housing in our region. Staff have been working closely with the department, with DTSC, the property owner, and stakeholders throughout the cleanup and the redevelopment process, ensuring a successful project that supports community needs. Next update is on the former Burke Oil and Pacific Metal Craft cleanup under ECRG grant. The former Burke Oil and Pacific Metal Craft site in Bell Gardens is undergoing cleanup and redevelopment. It is approximately 4.3 acres in a mixed commercial, industrial, and residential area in a CalEnviro screen score within the 99th percentile. On the western portion of the site, the former Burke Oil operated asphalt mixing and oil distribution. On the eastern portions of the site, Pacific Metal Craft fabricated metal and plastic parts and operated a degreaser. The site is impacted by VOCs, total petroleum hydrocarbons, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, and lead. The city of Bell Gardens received a $6.5 million ECRG grant for soil remediation. The city of Bell Gardens has completed the soil excavation and is continuing soil vapor extraction to remove the VOCs. Future planning by the city of Bell Gardens indicates that once the cleanup is completed, it will be redeveloped for affordable housing. In August of 2023, the city of Bell Gardens submitted a draft removal action work plan proposing removal of PAHs, lead-impacted soil by excavation, and installation of an SVE pilot test system. On March 15th of 2024, the Los Angeles Water Board adopted a mitigated negative declaration under the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, and approved the removal action work plan. Approximately 8,850 cubic yards of impacted soil were removed and disposed of off-site. As of today, the excavation scope of work under ECRG grant has been completed, and the SVE pilot testing scope is still ongoing, and the SVE test pilot plan addendum is still ongoing. We'll continue to update the board on future significant milestones. And for my last update, the Watershed Regulatory Section staff attended the Water Reuse California Annual Conference. On September 21st to the 23rd, 2025, Watershed Regulatory Section staff attended the Water Reuse California Annual Conference in San Diego, California. This event is essential. It's an essential summit for California's water recycling community, offering a platform for education and knowledge exchange, and showcasing the latest innovations in water recycling research, design operations, and management. This year's conference focused on several key areas, including implementing data management with artificial intelligence and machine learning, updates to direct potable reuse strategies, advances in membrane bioreactors, source control and pretreatment, and research findings on constituents of emerging concerns such as PFAS. In addition, the conference highlighted success stories in non-potable reuse and indirect potable reuse throughout California. The insight and connections gained from the conference will equip staff with knowledge needed to make more informed regulatory decisions and further implement the state's recycled water initiatives. And this concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the executive officer under her report? Yep, go ahead.
Just some comments. Glad to see that these low-income housing projects are moving forward, and so when they do have their ribbon cutting, make sure to invite us there. We like to see these types of success stories. And I'm also really glad that regulatory staff went to the water reuse conference and maybe utilizing that knowledge to impart. I know that the county water plan is looking at developing a consortium, and so maybe some of that information gain could be spread and discussed even further and deeply through that consortium that's being planned.
Exactly. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. All right, next item on the agenda is public forum. So any person may address the board regarding... My apologies, everybody. All right, any person may address the board regarding any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided the matter does not appear elsewhere on the agenda, has not been included to appear on a future agenda, and is not expected to be imminently scheduled for the board's consideration. So next, we will proceed with public forum. Each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board unless additional time has been approved in advance. Note that comments during public forum should be on items that are not pending or scheduled to appear on a future agenda, and which are not otherwise on today's agenda. So the order of speakers will be, first, in-person speakers, second, those that have registered in advance to speak remotely, and third, any others participating remotely that wish to speak. After in-person speakers are concluded, those that are registered in advance via the online registration form to speak remotely via Zoom will be asked to raise their, quotes, Zoom hand, close quotes. After those that have registered in advance have spoken, the chair will ask that any others wishing to speak raise their Zoom hand. So I believe that in terms of our in-person speakers today, Mr. Ray Tahir in person and Mr.
Excuse me, Chair. We skipped over an update from the State Board, Laurel Firestone.
I've done that before, haven't I?
It's okay.
Yes.
Can we go to her first and then move into public comment?
Yes. Yes, we do. So let's please hear from Board Member Firestone with abject apologies. I think that's the second time that I've done that. And my apologies, Board Member Firestone, and to everybody here. So sorry about that.
Oh, no. Thank you. I'll be quick. And again, good to see you all. Just an update on what we've been up to. I think since we last talked, we had released in July a draft update to the Bay Delta plan, and we're going to hold hearings. We have rescinded the notice for hearings and are planning to issue a full CEQA recirculation documents and revised draft plan. Right now, the plan is to do that in December and hold the hearings in late January, but the dates are yet to be set. We're also continuing on the Delta Conveyance Project and the Sites Reservoir Project hearings and consideration through the Administrative Hearings Office. We're continuing to convene, and tomorrow is the next advisory group meeting of the wastewater needs assessment that is modeled off of the drinking water needs assessment and is being led by a number of universities, including the Luskin Center at UCLA. We are continuing to move forward, and I think since we last met, have actually started our agricultural expert panel, and I wanted to mention this in particular. This is a process where we've convened experts on nutrients in agricultural practices. We have a set of, I think, 9 very detailed panel charge questions or questions that we're asking them. And they're meeting, they've had a number of public sessions, listening sessions, working sessions. The next full panel session is Halloween, October 31st. There'll probably be continued working group sessions. All of the deliberations are in public, but this is one where almost every region, but including this region, has given updates on where we are in terms of irrigated land regulatory programs and the unique characteristics of agriculture in different parts of our state. Some of the questions are about how we think about collecting data and setting limits to look at reducing nitrogen loading in groundwater, but also looking at how we best incorporate factors to incentivize and recognize the importance of regenerative ag, cover crops, different diversified and small farmers, and just different crop and hydrologic differences around the state. So I think stay tuned. This is something that, you know, once we get their report, I think will be an opportunity to consider how we continue to refine our irrigated lands regulatory programs. We also are continuing to collaborate with the California Natural Resources Agency to implement the State of Emergency Proclamation to fast track critical fuels reduction projects. So we have helped review and facilitate over 100 projects with the California Wildfire and Forest Resilience Task Force. And eligible projects need to apply by the end of this year, December 31st. We just launched, this is a big deal for us, but just launched our California Water Accounting Tracking and Reporting System, or Cal Water. So this is completely revamping how our water rights reporting, tracking, accounting system works. We retired a very old system. We're digitizing paper records and really working to make it easier for water rights holders to report, but also importantly for the public to access information on water rights. And this is, we just launched this and are holding workshops around with virtual and around the state around how to use this new system. And I think the other thing I would just mention is we've adopted our clean water and drinking water intended use plans. I think I've already reported to you on that. But as part of our kind of year-end review, fiscal year-end review, we did just an update on our water infrastructure investments. And the State Water Board provided over $2 billion over the past fiscal year to water systems and wastewater systems and water capture, recycle, cleanup, recharge, stormwater projects in about 390 communities. And those projects will benefit 18 million Californians. They add up to about 5,000 acre feet of water supply. But just importantly, I think recognizing that a lot of that funding comes through federal funding, and there's a lot of uncertainty around the state revolving funds for both drinking water and wastewater. And so we'll continue to, hope that we can count on federal funding as continuing to fund important work. In the meantime, there is a lot of state investments, and we are we do have our current funding allocation for this year, and are moving forward on committing funds and expending funds. So with that, happy to answer questions, and thanks for squeezing me in, and look forward to seeing you all soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for Board Member Firestone? All right. Well, I just wanted to say, well, you know, thank you. Thank you for being our liaison to the State Board. Thank you for your reports, which are always so informative and so interesting. And thank you to you and to the other members of the State Board for all of the work that you're doing in truly challenging times, in chaotic times. And but there is nonetheless so much work that is going on in terms of, again, environmental protections, so, you know, water issues, climate issues, and so on. So I just wanted to thank you for your reports every time. And I didn't have any other questions or comments, and I think Board Member Camacho.
Yes, and I want to second those comments as well from Chair Nahai. One question I did have is in regards to the Cal Waters. And so did I hear you say that it is going to be available to the public as well, not only those with water rights, and that we would all have to establish some type of account in order to access the information?
Gosh, that's a good question about if you have to start an account. But you definitely have to have an account in order to report. But the benefit is now you can look up water rights, and there's GIS and kind of visual maps you can access in usable format rather than in sort of a paper record. All of the reported data, and we are working on, we're going through every paper file. We're not there yet of all of the paper files, but digitizing everyone so that you can access it. I don't believe you need an account just to, for the public to access it, but there are virtual kind of workshops that are really focused on water rights holders setting up their accounts and how to do that input and reporting.
Well, this is all really great news, and so really looking forward to seeing that information and data. Thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you very, very much, Board Member Farson. Thanks for your presentation and for being with us today. All right, so next, we are going to go to public forum. Okay, I can see our executive officer is not going to let me forget that I skipped over that. So I'm just going to repeat the whole thing all over again. So public forum. Any person may address the board regarding any matter within the board's jurisdiction, providing the matter does not appear elsewhere on this agenda, has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda, and is not expected to be imminently scheduled for the board's consideration. Next, we will proceed with public forum. Each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board unless additional time was approved in advance. Note that comments during public forum should be on items that are not pending or scheduled to appear on a future agenda and which are not otherwise on today's agenda. The order of speakers will be, first, in-person speakers, second, those that registered in advance to speak remotely, and third, any others participating remotely that wish to speak. After in-person speakers are concluded, those that are registered in advance via the online registration form to speak remotely via Zoom will be asked to raise their Zoom hand. After those that have registered in advance have spoken, the chair will ask that any others wishing to speak raise their Zoom hand. So, Our in-person speakers today are Ray Tahir and Walter Lamb. Our remote speakers, that at least that I have, are Al Sexton of the city of Simi Valley and Annalisa Moe of Gilda Bay. So first, we will start with Mr. Tahir for 3 minutes.
Next slide, please. Good morning, board members.
Good morning.
Next slide, please. Under Bagley-Keene, the board is compelled to respond to questions presented during meetings. Note the State Water Board recognizes and has responded to my questions during and after its meetings. To that end, please respond to the following. Why didn't the regional board adopt the 2023 triennial review, which is a state and federal requirement? The purpose of the TR is to update the TMDL 303 D list, which identifies impaired waters and is necessary to protecting a water body's beneficial use. This will become an important issue when the next MS4 permit comes up for reissuance. It is unclear why this was not done. Next, why didn't the regional board update Basin Plan Chapter 7, TMDL, which was adopted in 2011? The 303D TMDLs in Chapter 7 are antiquated. They were used in the LA Ventura MS4 permit, but the TMDLs are based on outdated 2014-2016 303D list. The 303D list was adopted in 2018, 2020, 2022, and 24. That is the list. As a result, TMDLs in the current MS4 permit are unenforceable. It is unclear why Chapter 7 was not updated accordingly. So how does the board intend to correct this problem, given that Chapter 7 has no purpose? Next slide, please. Next slide, please. The board's recent enforcement action against the Dominguez Channel Machado Lake MS4 permittees was for noncompliance with nutrients and pesticides TMDLs based on the 2016 303D TMDL list. TMDLs are converted into water quality-based effluent limits where compliance is determined at outfalls. The DCML permittees were accused of exceeding numeric WQ bills for nutrients and pesticides. However, several of the 2016 TMDLs for nutrients and pesticides were delisted under the 2024 and 2020 303 D list, thereby rendering enforcement action unjustified. Will the regional board correct this error? Will it return the fines to the permittees? As I and City of Norwalk mentioned on several occasions, the regional board recommended a continuation of receiving water monitoring, which began in 2015, despite the fact that the data generated from it was not measured against water quality standards. This is very important. In fact, it serves no purpose whatsoever. The cost of the monitoring is staggering. Why is the regional board continuing to recommend monitoring if it serves no purpose or imposes heavy fines on permittees? Next slide, please. More consequential and concerning is the fact that the regional board did not adopt water quality standards for several toxics as required by the California Toxics Rule, as well as non-toxic, nor were equivalent water quality objectives used. Federal and state law, and be mindful of this, require the adoption of water quality standards and objectives. Without them, beneficial uses are left unprotected. I have already reported this problem to the State Water Board, which is also culpable. How does the regional board intend to correct this serious problem? The regional board should respond to the following questions before the November regional board meeting. I look forward to your responses. Note that the foregoing issues are in violation of state and federal law, will be raised by the State Senate Committee on Environmental Quality and U.S. EPA Region 9 because of the failure to comply risk impairment to water body beneficial uses. Complaints will also be filed with the governor's audit and with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Thank you for your attention. Oh, by the way, could you ask the State Board?
Excuse me, we're
yeah, over. But there was a delay for at least 40 seconds. It's only going to take 5 seconds. Can you do that for me, please?
I'm sorry?
Can you do that for me, please? Because there was a lapse in the slide.
Sure, go ahead.
And it's real simple. The Supreme Court, I would like the Office of Chief Counsel, with the help of Nunez, to review the Supreme Court's decision on Raimondo versus Commerce, striking down the seven doctrine and its impact on regulatory agencies. And also the Supreme Court's decision on the City and County of San Francisco versus US EPA, and its impact on compliance with WQ bills. And the Fifth Circuit decision in Camarillo Sanitary versus State Water Resources Board on toxicity monitoring, which is a current MS4 requirement. Next time up here, could you post the timer?
Okay.
Can you do that, man? Post the timer. Thank you very much.
All right. Our next in-person speaker is Mr. Walter Lam for 5 minutes to talk about Bayona.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chair Nahai, board members. Walter Lam, representing the Bayona Wetlands Land Trust, and here today to, again, hopefully try to get off this never-ending merry-go-round of the planning process for implementation of the Bayona Wetlands TMDLs that were established in 2012. I should have a slide presentation. No worries. So in July, you know, we have this unfortunate situation where, you know, I come and I'll speak, and then there will be comments afterwards, and I have to wait, in this case, 3 months to address them. But when I came to the July meeting, I prepared the same way I do for every meeting. One of the first things I do is I read the executive officer's report, because I want to hear what staff has to say so that I can make meaningful comments. And just waiting for that presentation to come up. No worries. Thank you. So when I read the July executive officer's report, I knew that there had been a comment months earlier that staff was trying to help CDFW find funding, that they were hoping to report good news. So when I read instead that the money that staff was seeking had dried up, or was cut out, that seemed like a pretty big setback, because that's everything we've been talking about now for years is the funding to revise this EIR, which is actually one small part of the process. And so when I saw that staff said that they're trying to find other sources of funding, it seemed appropriate at this meeting to ask what those other sources of funding were. Chair Nahai, you took pretty strong exception to that, and you indicated that I was asking questions that were not only outside the realm of this board, but that I was doing so intentionally. And so I just want to set the record straight. I don't do that. When I come to a meeting, I prepare. I read the executive report. I don't know if you did. And I think my question was actually right on target, and I still don't have an answer. So, Vice Chair Asjan, you had indicated, you took exception to the fact that I said that there was a lack of transparency. But what's interesting is I still don't have an answer to the question. So, as an environmental activist, I'm kind of used to that. Transparency to us means when we're seeking information, that we get it, unless it's a national security issue. I still don't have it. And there's no reference to the Bayona Wetlands in the October EO report. So we're not really making progress on that. If I could have the next slide, please. So I just want to clarify again, because there seems to be a lot of confusion, that the Bayona Wetlands TMDLs and the Bayona Wetlands Restoration Project are not the same thing. The Bayona Wetlands Restoration Project, it's fine if your staff thinks that that's what's going to eventually implement the TMDLs. But to the extent that that project turns out not to be feasible, it doesn't mean that the TMDLs go away. You, and not the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or the regulatory agency has the authority to enforce the TMDLs. That's why I come to these meetings. I do also have conversations with CDFW. Next slide, please. I just want to kind of stress there that I am in the right place for this discussion. We'll get the next slide whenever we can get. Sorry. The need for federal permit, no, I apologize. I said that when the last slide, but yeah, thank you. So the need for federal permits, there's no dispute here, right? It's right on CDFW's website. They can't do this project until they get the federal permits. And so when your staff says that it's irrelevant whether they need a federal permit to do the project, they're essentially saying that it's irrelevant whether they need a federal permit to implement the TMDLs, and that can't be the case. I think, Chair Nahai, you know that. I think you have pretty strong analytical skills. And so I think you can decipher through those things and say that doesn't make sense. If there's a roadblock to implementing the TMDLs, it's important for you to understand what that roadblock is. So CDFW is not actively pursuing those federal approvals. That's where we're trying to get untracked here. Next slide, please. And I really want to stress that the really minimal basic thing that we're requesting is a schedule. Now, I know that you've successfully run a lot of businesses, as well as some big agencies. And so I think you know that a schedule is a basic, harmless management tool. There's no threat in developing a schedule. This is a schedule for the same process from 21 years ago, 2004. And it shows that they're hoping to be finished with the planning process by the end of 2007. So clearly, something is wrong. And it can't be that our litigation caused all these delays, because we didn't file litigation until January of 2020, and the ruling wasn't until 2023. So there's something going on other than litigation that I think needs to be addressed as to why this keeps spinning in circles. We're asking for a schedule like this, but just an updated schedule that says, where it says now, you know, finish the EIR and EIS at the end of 2007. What's the new date for doing that? That's all we're asking for. Pretty bit straightforward. And I think, do I have one more slide, or was that the last? I think I might have one more slide. Or maybe that was the last one. So it would just be great. The other thing is, when we get the schedule, what we think is going to show is that the project as designed is not viable. And then that's going to generate discussions of how else can we achieve the TMDL targets. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and have a good rest of your meeting.
Thank you. And I will have some questions for staff once we've heard from all of the speakers. So I don't have any other in-person cards. The next speaker is Al Sexton, City of Simi Valley, for 3 minutes virtually. Do we have that?
Good afternoon, or good morning, Chair and board members. Al Sexton, City of Simi Valley. I'm waiving my time. I was originally registered to comment on item 9, and I'm waiving my time at this point. I'm available for questions.
All right, thank you very much. The final speaker I have remotely is Annalisa Moe from Heal the Bay for 5 minutes.
Hello, board members. Are you able to hear me? Is he not? Okay. Morning. My name is Annalisa Moe. I'm the Associate Director of Science and Policy at Heal the Bay. And I'm here to speak very briefly about this year's Beach Report Card and just very, you know, briefly touch on the River Report Card as well. In this short time, I'll just give a very brief overview, but I'm always happy to answer questions or, you know, follow up afterwards. And our reports are available online for those who would like to do a deeper dive. Very quickly, you know, this year's report was significantly delayed because of the wildfires. Our efforts were focused on some monitoring and data analysis around the wildfires. So our report came out in September, but it still covers the 2024 to 2025 rain year. And that means April 1st of 2024 to March 31st of 2025. So this is, you know, slightly older data that we are reviewing today, but I think it's still good to make sure we're all on the same page. We can go to the next slide. So Beach Report Card's been around for 35 years. We collect data from over 700 beaches up and down the West Coast, and then create a grade of A through F based on water quality, A or B meaning safe to swim, C, D, F meaning increased risk of, you know, gastrointestinal illnesses, eye infections, ear infections, those sorts of things. And we make this all available for free on our website and our app for, you know, public consumption. Next slide. We do have some good news from that previous year. You know, throughout our report, we have statewide kind of coastal and then county breakdown of water quality grades. So if you're interested in LA County, you can go to the LA County section of the report and see what the breakdown is and compare to the kind of five-year average to see if things are better or worse. But I just want to highlight here that water quality was pretty good in this rain year. We had 91% of beaches receiving A or B grades in the summer dry weather, 89% of beaches receiving A or B grades in winter dry, and 76% receiving A or B in wet weather, which for wet weather is actually pretty good, even though it's certainly worse than the dry weather. We also had 62 beaches on our honor roll list, which means 62 beaches that had zero bacteria exceedances year round, which is very impressive. But we also need to highlight where we have some trouble areas. There are a number of our top 10 beach bummers down in the San Diego region impacted by runoff from the Tijuana River watershed. And then right here in Los Angeles, we had one beach bummer, which is actually number two on the list, but second only to Playa Blanca, which is technically across the border, and that is our Santa Monica Pier. Gila Bay is working with the city of Santa Monica this year to launch a task force to identify what's going on at the pier and try to address it. And then we also had some up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And these are the top 10 worst beaches. These are not the only F grades. We also had additional F grades on our beach bum, or on our report card this year. Next slide. Just to give you a heads up, we also have a couple of special. Area. We worked with San Francisco Bay Keeping there, and we also have a special section on Ash to Action summarizing our work and also looking at what bacteria is doing during that time. Again, this report goes through March 31st of 2025, so we do have data during and after the fire event. So we looked into that and did see that bacteria levels did increase somewhat dramatically right around the fire event. Next slide, please. So overall trends is that water quality improved in 2024. This is likely linked to a very dry year for the 2024 to 2025 season, but also noting climate whiplash. We had a dry year this past that year, but the two previous years were two of the wettest years on record, and we saw dramatically declined water quality during those 2 years. So we're doing pretty well at capturing those smaller storms, but there's a lot we can still do to capture the bigger storms. And of course, we do still have those persistent hotspots that I mentioned earlier. Next slide, please. So rule of thumb, don't swim within 3 days of a storm. Don't swim within 100 yards of a storm drain. Go to the next slide since I'm almost out of time. I just want to also mention that we do have our river report card. I'm happy to come back next month and talk more about what the results of that report are. Go to the next slide. All right, and that's all we've got. So thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. And we very much look forward to hearing the report card, the river report card at our next meeting. And thank you for agreeing to split the two presentations. So questions for Ms. Moe. Go ahead, Board Member Mendez.
Great. Thank you so much, Annalisa. I always appreciate the thorough reports you give and your organization does on behalf of Los Angeles and our waterways. I had a quick question about the dry year reporting. You mentioned that it was improved in 2024. But the previous 2 years were the wettest years on record or in modern record keeping. And the most recent dry year, how does 2024 water quality compare? So like maybe in 2021 when it was a much drier year.
Yeah, so the wet weather is still higher than the five-year average. The dry weather summer and winter are sort of on par with what we were seeing before, around 90% being safe to swim. In the last 2 years, what really changed was the winter dry weather declined, which was sort of unusual. So compared to previous dry years, dry weather grades are about the same. Wet weather improved a bit. In that year, the biggest thing I think was the number of honor rolls. That is one of the highest numbers of honor roll beaches that we've seen. Typically, we would see somewhere around 30 to 50. And in previous, more recent dry years like 2021, we were seeing that 30 to 50 range. And this year we saw 62, which was much higher.
Okay, well, thank you. That's very helpful. And I also look forward to the river report. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Board Member Camacho.
Yes, thank you. And again, Annalisa Moe, thank you so much for your detailed report, and looking forward to the river report card as well. So one question I had in regards to the river report card is, have you been able to send that data to the County Public Works for incorporation into the initial watershed plans or their watershed planning tool? Because I think that data could be very helpful.
That is a great point. We're actually working with a group of students at UC Santa Barbara, mind blank for a minute, looking at all of our river report card data from the past 10 years. And we have LA County folks as advisors to that project to make sure that what we produce will be helpful for that portion of the LA County water plan. So it will definitely be included, but thank you for the reminder, because we can always send them the reports now.
Thank you.
Hi. Nice to hear from you again. Thank you so much for your work. I just have one question. I noticed in your presentation the water quality sampling that you did after the fires indicated that the runoff was affecting the beach report scores. Can the same be said for the river report? Did you find the same sort of patterns when you sampled that water?
That is a great question, Marissa, and I can cover this in more detail next month, but the river report card would that we released recently only covers the summer of 2024. So that really gives us a great baseline of pre-fire data to, you know, consider. We are in the process of finishing up analysis for this summer's sampling season, which ended at the end of September, and that's going to give us our post-fire data. So we will definitely be doing a special section in this year's report looking at the changes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. And just wanted to add, Vice Chair Ashton, did you have any questions?
No, I just echo the thank you to Annalisa and her colleagues for this work and for splitting the river portion into next month's meeting for our timing purposes. Appreciate it. And always great to hear the work that they're doing and the good news regarding so many honor rolls. Thank you.
Yes, I think a lot of good news, but so much more left to do. And I really look forward to the day when we will all rename Mother's Beach. It should be renamed Bad Mother's Beach or something like that. But every time it's polluted. Annalisa Hilde-Bay, thank you so much for this work that you do. This is really an invaluable service, and I know that many families heading off to the beach with their kids look at the beach report card before they do that. So it's really a great service. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. I had some questions for staff from a couple of things that were raised during the public forum. Mr. Tahir raised some questions which I think need to be responded to. He asked why the triennial review had not been done. He asked why the basin plan update had not occurred within a certain time. He raised the question of delisted items, which I believe has already been responded to previously. If it has been, then I don't think there's a need to respond to it again. But with respect to the triennial review and the basin plan, I think we should provide him with a response. If you have it now, fine. If not, it can be done in writing. And finally, he raised the question of monitoring, which he felt was wasteful. And I think we need to respond to him on that issue as well. So we can, again, you don't need to do it right now if you're not prepared. Okay, so please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair. This is Jenny Newman. I can respond quickly verbally right now to the question, why did the board not adopt the 2023 triennial review? The board did adopt the 2023 triennial review in March 2024. Then why did the board not adopt, or why has the board not updated Chapter 7, which is the chapter in our basin plan that includes all of the TMDLs? That's an administrative update that we do on occasion. The last one was many years ago, but it is not necessary or legally required that we do so. The basin plan amendments are a part of the basin plan, and they are on our website. They're just not in Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is like a static chapter, while the basin plan is a living document. So the living portions of the basin plan are on our website. The question about the EPLs in Machado Lake and the delisting of certain pollutants under those TMDLs, whether or not those pollutants have been delisted from Machado Lake is irrelevant. The TMDL is still in effect, and there are often pollutants in TMDLs that have been delisted, but the TMDL still stays in place to prevent relisting. If that were the case, I don't know the specifics off the top of my head, but even if there were delistings, it would not affect the standing of the TMDL.
Okay.
And then for the receiving water monitoring, the staff believes this is necessary and legal. We have the authority to require receiving water monitoring of our MS4 permittees and other dischargers. It's necessary to assess the impact of the discharges on the receiving water. Sometimes we need paired sampling. We need effluent sampling plus receiving water sampling to see the effect. It's also necessary just to assess the ongoing holistic health of the receiving water body to implement TMDLs and to measure compliance with water quality standards.
All right, thank you. Thanks very much. And then Mr. Lamb, at the end of his presentation, was asking for an updated schedule. I don't know whether that is something that the regional board can provide, given what is happening at Fish and Wildlife. But is there a response that we can provide to him?
Sure. This is Jenny again, and our response is that we continue. So staff has said in the past at board meetings that we do not think it is necessary to adopt an implementation plan or schedule for the Biona Wetlands TMDL because there is an ongoing program in place to address it. We do not think that by us, the regional board, adopting a plan or schedule, it would compel Fish and Wildlife to act any faster to complete that project. And instead, we have been working with them to track their progress and to help them find funding for various stages of the project, as well as when it comes time, we will be the permitting authority for permitting various phases of the project. We're not to that point yet. We're still in the planning part. And at one point, after staff had provided that response, the board asked staff to have a standing executive officer report item in the written report and to show our work doing that tracking and our providing that assistance. And we did not have anything significant to report for this month's executive officer report, so we didn't include anything. But I can say that we have been talking with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it's our understanding that they have not identified. So what Mr. Lamb said about previous executive officer reports, that we were working with Fish and Wildlife to secure funding. The funding that we had identified had fallen through. We do not want to disclose publicly our initial preliminary brainstorming thoughts about what kind of funding might be available. I don't think that's not being transparent. We just don't want to raise people's hopes that there might be funding and then I'll have it become a reality. And so we do not think we need to talk about our preliminary thoughts. That being said, you know, Fish and Wildlife is pursuing funding on their own, and it's my understanding that they have not identified an alternative source of funding to do the work to recertify the EIR in response to the court order, but they are doing the work themselves now. With their internal resources, I understand. And so I expect that they will recertify the EIR soon.
Soon, but we don't know when.
No, but I think we will know when. I think I can provide you a report at the next board meeting as to the schedule of when that might happen.
Okay. Yeah, I think we would appreciate hearing an update on that.
Do you mind if I also?
No, of course.
Go, please. I feel your pain. I have also run into some recent hiccups with another federal department. So it's something that's definitely plaguing the system right now. Can you talk a little bit about what the funding shortfall is and whether or not Fish and Wildlife actually has the manpower to do it internally, and if outside funding were to be identified, would they accept external help?
I can't say what Fish and Wildlife's resource situation is and if they have the internal manpower to do it. But they are another state agency, and they have been subject to the same funding cuts that we have been over the last two years. So it's not good. I will need a minute, and I may need to talk to staff about the exact amount that contract that we were pursuing was for. I believe it was $170,000 roughly. But I'm not sure, so I need a minute to go find out the cost of the contract that was contracted.
I mean, it's helpful just to know the ballpark. That's not a lot of money.
No, it was not a lot of money, and I'm sure Fish and Wildlife would be, I'm sure, again, I'm speculating. I think they would like external funding, yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, just curious, you know, it's this moment in time where, because our federal agencies are struggling so much, it's trickling down and hard on our state agencies as well. But obviously this is a project that is and has been very important to the community and to the, you know, environmental groups across Los Angeles. And if there's some sort of mechanism, either incentive-wise or a little bit of friendly pressure to be applied, I think it's totally appropriate, because this has dragged on for a very long time, and we are talking about a very small amount of money.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
you. We'll look into that. Thank you.
Board Member Men.
Thank you. I also feel the concerns or how the community and environmental groups are concerned about this issue, and that it's taking so long, and our staff is trying to do the best that they can. And I know oftentimes you come here because we're one of the most open or a board that meets more regularly, where you can air your concerns. But I would also like to know, next time you come and present in an open forum, also about a little bit about your advocacy or your outreach methods to the California Natural Resources Agency, the Secretary's Office, which oversees the Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as what efforts have you done meeting with your assembly members and your state senators that also can apply some of that pressure that my colleague is talking about in finding through the budgetary process funding. So in your next report to us in public forum, I would appreciate hearing more of your outreach efforts to CNRA, your state senator, your assembly member, about finding appropriate funding as well. And this is a process that all NGOs have to do, hit the ground and, you know, knock on doors. And so I would love to hear that next time. Thank you.
All right. Any other?
Jenny.
Go ahead, Nora.
As a point of clarification, I looked up the email about the contract, and it was for $150,000 was the amount.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, and just one thing I just wanted to mention to staff is even if there is nothing to report on Bayona Wetlands, let's just keep it as a line item there so that it doesn't drop off in our executive officer report. Thanks.
All right. Okay, thank you. We'll move on then. next are, so did we decide to move the uncontested item to the contested calendar? Or how did the lawyers? I have some questions on the next item, the WRRs. And I understand because the dischargers don't have any comments, it was moved to the uncontested calendar. However, it's my understanding anyway that if board members have questions, then it needs to be moved to the contested category. Now, we don't have to do that. It's just that I would like to hear a presentation, and I do have questions on it. So
Are your questions likely to result in changes to the... Okay, it's fine to just move it to
not,
the...
It's not just an academic exercise.
Then
I mean, they may. I mean, depending on what the answers are. So for instance, a question such as, you know, you say this water, the wastewater cannot be next to a drinking water well, but you've deleted that it cannot be next to another water body. Why have you made that deletion? You say that radioactivity has been deleted. Well, why has that deletion been? Now, so it could lead to changes, but I'm not sure. It could be that staff will tell me, well, Mr. Nahai, are you paying attention? And I could be corrected, as I often am. So I don't know whether there will be changes as a result.
Ellie San is also here, and they could also respond to the questions the board might have, along with the city of Simi Valley.
Staff has prepared a full presentation, and as of this morning, it was still on the contested items calendar, and so we're happy to move forward and have staff presentation, discussion, board questions. And I think your question is, though, if the board wants to make revisions in response to that discussion, can we do that? And I think we can, but I wanted to, that's what...
Yes. It was just... I think it's cleaner if we just move it back to the contested calendar just in case.
Okay. So just legally, it's being moved to the contested item. Okay. All right. Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, is this on? Yeah. Okay. Okay.
All right.
Oh, my presentation's up. Are we ready to go?
Do I need to? Yeah. Okay. I need to do it. Okay. So the next item on our contested items calendar are water reclamation requirements, WRRs. And this is consideration of a tentative amendment to water reclamation requirements for the Los Angeles County Sanitation District's Long Beach Water Reclamation Plant, Long Beach, California, file number 69-80, San Jose Creek Water Reclamation Plant in Whittier, and that's file number 7750, the Saugus Water Reclamation Plant in Santa Clarita, and that's file number 61-30, and Valencia Water Reclamation Plant, and that's in Valencia, and that's file number 65-86. Also, the Las Virgenes Municipal Water District, this is the Tapia Water Reclamation Facility in Calabasas, that's file number 64-104. The City of Ventura, or City of Buenaventura, which is the Ventura Water Reclamation Facility, and the City of Simi Valley, which is the Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant in Simi Valley, California, and that's file number 61-60. The comment submittal deadline for these items was September 25th, 2025, and we will listen to the presentation from Mr. Webb.
All right, thank you.
Chair Nahai, since we're moving into the contested calendar, would it be possible to have people do the oath?
Okay. So for all those who are going to testify on this item, could you stand up and raise your hand, please? Okay. And please repeat after me. I swear to tell the truth.
I swear to tell the truth.
The whole truth.
The whole truth.
And nothing but the truth.
Nothing but the truth.
Under penalty of perjury. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Good morning, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Stephen Webb. I'm the supervisor of the Municipal Permitting Unit. Also present with me today are Michelle Campbell, the project engineer for this item, sitting right up front here, and then Jonghee Lim, the manager of the Watershed Regulatory Section, also sitting right up here in the front. Item number 9 is a consideration of an amendment to the Water Reclamation Requirements, or WRRs, for 7 Water Reclamation Plants, or WRPs, Long Beach, San Jose Creek, Saugus, Valencia, Tapia, Ventura, and Simi Valley. This item is uncontested because the Los Angeles Water Board staff addressed all stakeholder comments. However, the topic of recycled water is timely and of interest to the board, so we created a brief presentation summarizing the item. Next slide, please. The 7 water reclamation plants associated with this amendment produce disinfected tertiary recycled water for non-potable reuse. The WRRs for each of these facilities were originally adopted in 1987 and readopted with no revisions in 1997. Since then, there have been significant updates to the recycled water requirements in Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations, and the State Water Resources Control Board's policy for water quality control for recycled water, or the recycled water policy, was adopted. The purpose of this amendment is to make the existing WRRs consistent with the current standards to ensure safe, consistent, and sustainable implementation of recycled water use across the region. Next slide, please. Section 11.3.2 of the Recycled Water Policy requires regional boards to review and update recycled water permits and/or the monitoring and reporting programs to be consistent with the Recycled Water Policy, an approved Title 22 engineering report, and the Basin Plan. In addition, Section 11.3.2 of the Recycled Water Policy requires regional boards to enroll permittees in the State Water Board's water reclamation requirements for recycled water use, or order number WQ 2016-0068-DDW, or simply the general order. The general order serves as a single permit that standardizes how recycled water is treated, monitored, and reported across California for non-potable reuse. The recycled water policy further states in section 11.3.3 that regional boards shall prioritize and update orders, permits, and monitoring and reporting programs that were issued prior to January 1st, 2001. Each of the WRRs being amended here were all issued in 1987 and readopted in 1997. Therefore, amending these orders is consistent with the recycled water policy. Next slide, please. As I just mentioned in the previous slide, Section 11.3.2 of the Recycled Water Policy requires regional boards to enroll permittees in the general order, if appropriate. The 7 facilities being amended by this order are all eligible to be enrolled in the general order because they all use disinfected tertiary recycled water for non-potable uses, and their impact to groundwater is minimal. However, for dischargers to enroll in the general order, there are 3 main steps that must occur. First, the Title 22 engineering report for the facility must receive conditional acceptance letter from DDW to ensure public health is protected. Second, the discharger must submit an application and the associated fee to the regional board to enroll in the general order. Third, the Los Angeles Water Board will review the application and enroll the facility under the general order if appropriate. The Los Angeles Water Board considers site-specific factors when considering enrolling a facility in the general order. But the main consideration is ensuring the project has minimal impact to the groundwater. Many of the dischargers have already developed a draft Title 22 engineering report that is currently under review, but approval takes a significant amount of time, and the review is conducted by DDW. Therefore, it may take several years for the Title 22 engineering report currently under consideration to be approved. As a result, this amendment makes these WRRs consistent with current regulations while DDW works on reviewing the engineering reports to comply with the recycled water policy in the interim. Next slide, please. As stated earlier, this amendment updates the WRRs for Ventura, Long Beach, San Jose Creek, Saugus, Valencia, Tapia, and Simi Valley. These facilities have been producing disinfected tertiary recycled water for non-potable reuse, such as landscape irrigation, industrial cooling, and dust control. Each of these facilities also include similar processes to treat the municipal wastewater to make it suitable for non-potable reuse. Next slide, please. The generalized treatment process for producing disinfected tertiary recycled water suitable for non-potable reuse is relatively consistent among each of these seven facilities. The influent wastewater is first screened to remove large materials coming into the facility. The wastewater is then conveyed to a primary sedimentation tank where solids are removed by settling to the bottom of the tank. The flow is then conveyed to an aeration tank where microbiological processes consume the dissolved organics in the water. This process produces a mass of microorganisms called a flock that then settle to the bottom of the clarifiers, which is the next stage of the treatment process. The flow is then conveyed through a filtration process that helps remove more particulates, and the final step of the process is disinfection, which is commonly completed using some form of chlorination. The chlorinated water is then distributed through purple pipe network for non-potable uses, which is the discharge regulated by these WRRs. Each of these facilities also dechlorinate a portion of the flow that is discharged to surface water, which is covered under a separate MPDES permit. Recycled water used for non-potable uses has many benefits to the region, including creating a local source of water, thereby reducing the region's reliance on imported water, improving the watershed by diverting nutrients to use areas instead of surface waters like the ocean, and there is no generation of reverse osmosis brine, in contrast to potable reuse, which can be difficult to dispose of. Next slide, please. This slide summarizes the major updates this amendment makes to the WRRs. This amendment defines the water quality permitted for non-potable reuse, updates the permitted non-potable uses consistent with Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations, updates use area requirements, revises the monitoring and reporting program to be consistent with Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations and the recycled water policy, and updates notification procedures for spills and bypasses. Next slide, please. The public notice for the tentative order was issued on August 26, 2025, along with the revised WRRs for each facility and the associated monitoring and reporting program. The City of Ventura, Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts, Las Virgenes Municipal Water District, and the City of Simi Valley all submitted comments prior to the September 25, 2025 comment submittal deadline. In response to the comments received, Los Angeles Water Board staff revised the tentative order where appropriate, along with the revised WRRs for each facility and its associated monitoring and reporting program, and distributed the revised tentative order on October 16, 2025. The dischargers reviewed the revised tentative documents, found the revisions to be acceptable, and have no further comments on issues regarding the revised tentative documents. Next slide, please. This slide provides an overview of the board's options regarding the proposed revised tentative order, amending the WRRs for the seven facilities. The board may adopt the revised tentative order as a as proposed by staff, amending the WRRs for the 7 facilities. The board may modify and adopt the revised tentative order as a logical outgrowth of comments received. Or the board may choose to take no action today on the proposed revised tentative order and postpone consideration to a future meeting. Next slide, please. Staff recommends the board adopt the revised tentative order, amending the water reclamation requirements for the 7 facilities as proposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I know that I have a few questions, but I'll ask other board members if they have any. Board Member Christensen, none. Board Member Camacho? Board Member Mendez, any questions? Vice Chair Ashton, any questions on this item? Okay. Okay, so yep. I have a couple to ask you. Well, first, there were a couple of deletions that I couldn't understand. If you could explain them to me, please, Stephen. So first, on page 9-016, this section 2 says that there will be no impoundment of disinfected tertiary recycled water shall occur within 100 feet of any domestic water supply well.
Right.
Perfectly mm-hmm. reasonable. But then deleted are the words potable water reservoirs or streams used as sources of water supply. So if we're saying that this water cannot be within 100 feet of a domestic water supply well, why would it be within 100 feet of a potable water reservoir or within 100 feet of a stream used as a sort of source of water supply? Why shouldn't we have the same 100-foot buffer zone, for want of a better word?
Right. So that's so the in Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations, it specifically only states drinking water wells, and there's no discussion on rivers or reservoirs that are being used as a source of water supply. So that's why we're trying to be consistent with the Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations.
Also, we have a legal prohibition there to include that language then?
Yes.
Okay. All right, second deletion, and maybe it's the same response you're going to give me, is on page 9-018, and there was a requirement in section 14, which again seemed very reasonable to me, for there to be a physical barrier between this recycled water system and pipelines that are located along the property lines of homeowners so that there wouldn't be possible leakage of this water into people's property and so on, and that whole section was deleted as well. So are you going to tell me the same reason?
Well, okay, so that section is about cross connections, and that's something that the County of Public Health and DDW look into while approving plans for recycled water pipelines and the engineering reports, but we don't review those documents typically, and we leave the expertise to DDW and Public Health to make those requirements.
All right, so it's regulated not just by us.
Right,
is
right.
That's what correct. We're saying. Okay, and then throughout the document, there are these words that are added. It says the permittees or its designee. What exactly does that? You know, as a lawyer, you know, I don't know what that means.
So I believe that was a comment from the LA County Sanitation Districts, and it's mostly for reporting because they don't always report the they convey their recycled water to different recycled water or distributors. And then they report to their flows and things like and their water quality, how they're using the recycled water at their use sites and things like that. So,
you mean to say that really what they're doing is that the reporting functions would be outsourced? In effect,
or? Yeah. So if LA kind of Sanitation District wasn't reporting it, then it would be whoever they're supplying the water to that would be making those submittals.
And so the designee then, whatever that entity is, would somehow agree to be bound by the requirements of the permits?
Well, they have their own agreements with those entities.
So. Well, I understand yeah. that. What I'm trying to get to is whether there is a lessening of responsibility on the shoulders of the permittee, because it says the permittee or its designee shall do this report. Okay, so the report doesn't happen. Can the permittee say, oh, sorry, you know, I told my designee to do it. If they didn't do it, you go after them?
Well, I think the main thing is that they want their designee to be able to submit the report if they don't do it. So it's because as it
I know who's responsible if the report doesn't get submitted?
So the LA County Sanitation would be responsible because they're the permittee on this permit.
Okay. I'm not sure about that, by the way, because there's all of this or its designee. So because it should really just say the permittee shall submit the report. Now, if the permittee wants to get, you know, I mean, if I want to get one of my associates to go do it, I can't then say to a client, oh, you know what, it just said, you know, David or one of his associates will do it. The associate didn't do it, so David doesn't have responsibility for it. It's still my firm that has that responsibility. I'm not sure that by adding these words designee that we necessarily still visit responsibility on the permittee, but that's up to the lawyers to. I don't want to make a fuss about it. It's just all over the place. It's the permittee or its designee will have this responsibility. And I want the responsibility to be on the shoulders of the designee, even though they might have somebody else actually prepare the report. I'm sorry, Chung-Gi, I know you wanted to.
Good morning, Chair. Hi, my name is Chung Haley for the record. All the monitoring requirements, they do have, we designate the responsible party for that they have to submit it, that they're going to do it. And then when they designate it, they're supposed to monitor it, but submit the report. So especially for this subcontractor, like for example, for this case, like our permittee delivers water to somebody else and users. They do have their own users to deliver the water to use. So sometimes each second delivered water users, they could provide and ask the third person, final end users, to support the provide a monitoring report. In that case, they can sometimes, as a permittee, county sanitation district in this case, may not detailedly know what's going on in their project itself. So they can submit, allow for them to submit it, but they're part of the responsibility goes into with the permittee as permit holders. But at the same time, we're requiring them to have a specific enforcement or who's reliable when an enforcement issues comes along, so they do have to have an agreement in between what's going to do, what responsibility they're going to take it, and when it comes into the enforcement orders, who's going to take the responsibility for that. So they're all those contract agreements are in place, and that's the thing that we are required for them to submit it as well.
Okay, thank you. But for the sake of the record, right, the responsibility for submitting the reports rests with the permittee?
Yes, mainly, yes, and then the designee can submit it, yes.
No, I understand that the designee yes. also has to accept responsibility, but ultimately the permit is being issued to the permittee, and that's where the ultimate responsibility
yes.
lies. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then one of the questions, so radioactivity was deleted as a standard. Why was that done?
Radioactivity was a limit that was included in the permit back in 1987, and it's based on a maximum contaminant level for radioactivity, which is a drinking water standard. And the recycled water policy in Title 22 of the California Code of Regulations do not require meeting maximum contaminant levels for non-potable reuse. So when we got the comment regarding the the references for radioactivity, we decided just to remove that effluent limit altogether because it's not something that's required.
Okay. Okay. Then my final comment, there was, like, in terms of, you know, I understand completely that this water is non-potable and will never be and won't even, is not even at a standard that it could be diverted to spreading grounds and used for indirect. I understand that. But regarding just, and I'll just make this point, you know, regarding the signs that would be put up for folks, you know, it says that it would read, recycled water, do not drink, right? At some point, we need to revisit that nomenclature because at some point along the line here, pretty soon, we want to tell people recycled water, do drink, not this particular water. So it just kind of, people seeing that all over the place will believe that any kind of recycled water is not to be gone near. I mean, it's just, I'll just put that comment out there, not to change anything here, but perhaps, you know, calling it non-potable water, do not drink, or not suitable for drinking, or something like that would be better than kind of, you know, this condemnation of recycled water, which is what I'm seeing here. So that's right. All I have. I don't know if other members have any questions. No. Board Member Camacho.
Yes, in regards to the nomenclature of recycled water, I think when we are looking at, you know, water reuse for potable water needs, people are going towards the nomenclature of pure water, and that seems to be the direction that we seem to be going. But I'd like to hear from staff in terms of what your thoughts are, in terms of what the direction is going.
I'll speak, if it's okay, from a policy level, and then I might say something that perhaps our lawyers could confirm or check. We will certainly take that information and bring it to the various conferences, consortiums, other avenues that we participate in to have this discussion. But the language on those signs comes from, I believe, the Code of Regulations, if not statute. That's where I wanted the question. But we can't make that kind, obviously you didn't ask us to, we can't make that kind of decision about the writing on the signs, but we certainly can talk to those who do have that authority and bring it up as an issue.
It's in the regs, and there is a provision that allows a suggestion of alternative wording, as long as it's deemed by DDW to be sufficiently so that it's not confusing and that it's consistent with the intent. So there is some flexibility there that I think, you know, maybe as the consensus moves and we move more towards pure water, that'll be driven to drive those changes.
Okay. All right, that's all I have. I think so we're ready for a vote. Could I have a motion for approval? Move from Board Member Mendez. Have a second?
I'll second.
From Board Member Camacho. Could we have the roll call, please?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Yes.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Okay. The next item, first of all, are board members okay to anybody? You need. Okay. All right. We need to take a break for how long? 45 minutes?
45 minutes.
Okay. We'll take 10 minutes.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to take a break for 10 minutes. And we will return at 11 exactly.
Yes.
All right. Our next item is item, I think 12 on my thing could be 11, but this is an information item. and it's an update on the irrigated lands regulatory program. Our staff will present the status of implementation of order number R4-2023-0353, and the Ventura County Agriculture Irrigated Lands Group will give a demonstration of their member portal web tool Clear Water. And we'll hear from Alicia Wakefield.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Elijah Wakefield, and I'm the supervisor of the TMDL and Nonpoint Source Pollution Unit at the Los Angeles Water Board. I'm joined today by Dr. Celine Galan, the Environmental Program Manager for the Regional Program Section, and Mr. Rene De La Fuente, the newly hired Water Board Staff Lead on Irrigated Agriculture. Next slide, please. The permit regulating local irrigated agriculture is the general waste discharge requirements for discharges from irrigated lands within the Los Angeles region. It is often referred to as the Ag Order and was adopted by this board on September 28, 2023. Over the last 2 years, the TMDL Nonpoint Source Unit has been working with the discharger groups and growers to implement the permit. For this presentation, I'll give you an update on our activities, briefly go over some of our future plans, and also highlight some additional statewide irrigated lands regulatory efforts. As a refresher, growers may enroll in the irrigated lands regulatory program individually or through a discharger group. In our region, we have two discharger groups, the Los Angeles Irrigated Lands Group, or LAILG, and the Ventura County Agriculture Irrigated Lands Group, or VCALG. To date, we have no individual enrollees. Next slide. On screen are the requirements of the 2023 Ag Order. Some of these were carried over from the previous conditional waiver, while others were new to the Ag Order. The existing requirements included enrollment, education and fees, surface water monitoring, water quality management plans, and discharge limitations. There are new components as well. The biggest change and the one that provoked the most interest during the order adoption were the discharge limitation requirements, which contain the steps growers must complete to be in compliance with the discharge limitations already in the program. The remaining additional components to the order are the statewide precedential requirements from the State Water Board. These requirements include irrigation nutrient management plans and reports, expanded groundwater trend monitoring, groundwater protection metrics, and drinking water well monitoring. Next slide. Through the history of our ag permits, enrollment and education have been the foundation of our program. Growers enroll with one of the discharger groups. Each year, the groups report the number and acreage of properties enrolled in the program. Comparing data from 2022, as we went into the adoption of the ag order, we have seen the number of enrolled members in both groups increase. In Los Angeles County, enrolled acreage has increased as well, while acreage has decreased in Ventura County. In Los Angeles County, a lot of this increase has been due to the discharger group working with Southern California Edison to be more rigorous in making sure leased parcels are complying. Enrolled dischargers are required to complete 2 hours of continuing education classes per year, and the discharger groups help coordinate this effort by connecting growers to classes or presenting the classes themselves. The classes are often held in English and Spanish, and since COVID, many are available in hybrid or online format, increasing grower access to the material. Water Board staff have been present at some continued education sessions to be available for questions. Since Ag Order adoption, Water Board staff have continued to work with discharger groups on increasing enrollment. Next slide. A major role of the discharger groups has been to conduct annual surface water monitoring on behalf of their members. This task is to assess the impact of agricultural runoff on regional water quality and has been part of the Integrated Lands Program since 2007. For surface water monitoring, both LAILG and VCALG conduct representative monitoring. This means, rather than monitor discharge from every single farm, each discharger group assigns farms into a cohort based on similar characteristics and then picks a single monitoring site to characterize or represent what is being discharged from all farms in the group. Samples are analyzed for a number of constituents, such as pesticides, bacteria, and nutrients, because these analytes have been shown to have the potential to come from agricultural discharges. In Ventura County, they chose specific sites in agricultural drains or creeks downstream from farms. In Los Angeles County, there are no water bodies dominated by agricultural discharge, so they sample edge of field. Representative sites are sampled 2 times per year in Los Angeles County and 4 times per year in Ventura County. Annual monitoring reports summarizing the activities and results of these efforts are submitted. Both groups submitted their annual monitoring report in 2023 and 2024, with the next report due in December of this year. The Ag order also required updated countywide water quality management plans based on surface water monitoring, and these documents have been submitted by both groups. Next slide. As I mentioned earlier, when the Ag order was adopted, the biggest concern growers had centered on the compliance requirements for the discharge limitations, which are triggered by total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs. There are 17 TMDLs in our region that assign allocation to agriculture. 5 of these TMDLs apply to water bodies in Los Angeles County, and 17 apply to growers in Ventura County. The TMDLs and discharge limitations had been brought into the irrigated lands program under previously adopted waivers, but the compliance requirements were new to the Ag order and require additional individual efforts by growers. While the discharger groups are facilitating grower compliance with the discharge limitations, this is an individual requirement rather than a discharger group requirement. After the TMDL compliance deadline passes, if a TMDL-based benchmark, which is based on water quality objectives, is exceeded at a representative monitoring site, an individual discharge limitation is triggered for all growers represented by that monitoring site. The compliance requirements vary between county. Los Angeles County growers subject to discharge limitations are required to conduct edge of field sampling. Ventura County growers are required to conduct either edge of field sampling or may implement a farm level management practice plan, or MPP. Ventura County growers asked for and were granted this alternative due to the large number of overlapping TMDLs that may apply to a single farm in Ventura County. Next slide. So let's take a look at the steps for growers for each county. For Los Angeles County growers, if there is an exceedance at a representative monitoring site after the TMDL compliance date, the discharge limitation is triggered, and all sites in the group represented by the monitoring site must conduct individual monitoring. The sites have 2 years to meet the benchmark, or the discharge limitation is triggered for any newly monitored site not meeting the benchmark. As of yet, there has been no triggering of the discharge limitations in Los Angeles County. Next slide. As mentioned, Ventura County growers may choose one of two options for compliance. On slide is track 1. The first step is the same for both tracks. Following a notice of exceedance, the grower chooses a compliance pathway and submits a notice of intent to comply. For those growers planning to follow track 1, the next step is to develop an individual monitoring plan. There's a plan template on the Water Board website. Growers can put together a monitoring plan without a technical service provider. Staff has met with growers who requested help on this development. The plan is submitted to the Water Board and reviewed. Once it meets the program requirements, the plan is approved by the EO and the grower begins to implement the plan. The grower is required to submit an individual annual monitoring report. Sampling will occur each year until water quality benchmarks are attained at each location for 2 consecutive years, and then sampling will be monitored every 5 years. For this option, the grower only needs to analyze samples for the benchmarks triggering the discharge limitation, not the entire suite of region-wide benchmarks. Growers following track 1 are expected to meet discharge limitations and continue to implement needed BMPs to maintain compliance. If individual monitoring shows they're not meeting the discharge limitations, they may be subject to enforcement. Next slide. The steps for track 2 are on screen. For growers who choose to employ Track 2, the first step is the same as Track 1. Growers notify the Los Angeles Water Board and begin developing the farm-level management practice plan. This plan needs to be certified by a technical service provider. This could be staff at the Resource Conservation District or Natural Resources Conservation Service. But given limited resources for both agencies, it could also be a private provider. Once plans are completed and certified, they're submitted to the Water Board for executive officer review and approval. The grower must then begin implementation. The amount of time approved for implementation is dependent on the type and magnitude of the management practices included in the plan and whether the grower is a diversified, socially disadvantaged grower or practicing regenerative agriculture. Following completion of the implementation of the plan, growers will submit a notice of project completion and staff will inspect the site. The type of management practices that will be implemented via Track 2 are expected to address surface water impairments from agricultural discharges, but also provide benefits to ongoing regional efforts to retain the quality and quantity of groundwater supplies, as many of these practices discourage movement of water off-site and encourage infiltration. This aligns with other regional and statewide regulatory programs like SGMA. Next slide. In the Ag Order adoption meeting, we provided an initial MPP submittal schedule for the rollout of the discharge limitation compliance. The schedule was updated based on revised responsible area boundaries and the exceedances confirmed to date. The due dates for the first couple of responsibility areas, which are shown on screen, have already passed. Growers have submitted them on time, and they're in review. Next slide. Earlier in the presentation, I mentioned a number of statewide precedential requirements were incorporated into the Ag Order. In general, these additional tasks are focused on groundwater protection. They include drinking water well monitoring, irrigation and nutrient management, groundwater trend monitoring, and development of protection metrics. The drinking water well monitoring requirement is an individual grower task. The first round of monitoring for nitrate was conducted in 2024 and is continuing. Irrigation and nutrient management plans and reporting is a task split between growers and discharger groups. Growers prepare a certified irrigation and nutrient management plan for their operation, which is kept on farm. At the end of the year, they will complete an irrigation and nutrient management report detailing their water and fertilizer usage the previous year. This uses a template put together by the discharger group and will in turn be reported to the Water Board by the discharger group. The templates have been submitted to the Water Board and approved. The first reports are due March 1st, 2026. While VCalc had previously been required to submit groundwater trend monitoring, this is now a statewide requirement. Both groups have submitted their plans for approval. The final groundwater protection requirements are the development of groundwater protection formulas, values, and targets. These are not due until September of next year. Next slide. Since the order was adopted 2 years ago, a lot of work has been completed to address water quality impacts from agriculture. This is an ongoing program, and there is more work to be done. The tasks of enrollment, management practice plan reviews, and groundwater protection are ongoing. In the coming year, we anticipate more field visits to support enrollment increases, discharge limitations, and MPP completion. As part of our irrigated lands program, we have been working... Sorry, the mic... keeps popping. We have been working to reinvigorate the outreach that has always been part of our program. As we went through the COVID response and staff turnovers, both at the board and with program partners, there was a period of time where our outreach was stalled. Even before the adoption of the 2023 Ag Order, we stepped up these efforts, meeting monthly with the discharger groups. We have continued these meetings since the order adoption as we've worked through implementation challenges and looking for collaborative ways to improve water quality. TMDL and discharge limitation compliance has increased grower requests to both NRCS and Ventura County RCD staff. So we have met with their staff a number of times to align on how different agency resources can most effectively and efficiently be harnessed and utilized for these efforts. While staff has always been available to meet individually with growers, in April of this year, we began a trial project of holding office hours in Ventura County. About once a month, staff spends the day at Ventura County Farm Bureau to meet with growers, technical service providers, and others on a one-to-one basis. We are also working to attend more community events. Lastly, we are looking to step up our enrollment enforcement efforts. Next slide. In addition to our regional efforts for irrigated agriculture, State Water Board staff has recently also been involved in two major statewide projects. The first is the Regulatory Alignment Study. A contract was executed by California Department of Food and Agriculture, Cal-EPA, and State Water Boards to assess the various state regulations on agriculture and evaluate if there were opportunities for more efficiency and to reduce regulatory burden. Our staff provided subject matter information throughout the process and has provided comments on deliverables. The final report will be released in November and may result in future statewide changes to agriculture programs. The other current major State Water Board activity with regards to irrigated lands is the convening of the second statewide agricultural expert panel to advise on nitrogen groundwater issues. You heard a little bit about this earlier from State Water Board member Firestone. The panel was convened in August, and the final report is expected in early 2026. The panel consists of seven experts specializing in agriculture, nitrogen mobility, irrigation, and hydrology. They'll hold a number of plenary, listening, and working meetings over the next few months, looking at the state of nitrogen data related to agriculture and whether statewide groundwater nitrogen limits should be adopted. Next slide. So this completes our program update of what has been accomplished in 2 years since the Ag Order was adopted. Thank you, and I'm sure you have questions.
Thank you. I'll have some questions after we hear from VCalg, but I have one question for you. Any questions right now?
Sure. Again, thank you for all the work. It's hard to believe this was 2 years ago, and really encouraged about the office hours that you're holding, and just wondering how many people are taking advantage of that.
It actually has been, I would say, surprisingly a lot. I should have counted the numbers, but we're trying to get there, depending on what we've set up, between 9 and 10 in the morning, and we stay until somewhere between 3:30 and 5, depending on the need. So we're usually booked pretty consistently throughout the day. Somewhere, I think we usually have half an hour sessions. We can do longer if there's a runover or additional need. Okay, and we followed those up with, in some cases, individual calls or video chats with growers who wanted more information following the one-to-ones.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you to the Farm Bureau for hosting the board there as well, and I'm sure they're doing outreach to their constituents. And then the second question, if you can just remind me on track two, what is the schedule based on the type of farm it is?
In terms of the schedule was laid out based on the region is, the county split into responsibility areas that are basically geographically clustered. So we divided the schedule looking at geography and in general moving.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant for Ventura and the management practice plan, the biogenerative and.
They get an extra year.
An extra year. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I wasn't clear. Thank you for that. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Oh, and have there been any that are taking that up?
I'm not 100% sure. We've had a lot. Renee, do you know? I don't think we have. Not that I've seen, but we have several hundred notice of intents, so we have them all. I can get that information confirmed.
Yeah, just make sure that you're tracking that for
us. Yeah,
next
we have
time.
It tracked in our files.
All right, thank you.
And you'll hear I think that's part of maybe part of Jody's presentation as well about the tool from VCal. I don't know, is that included in? Okay. You'll hear. Yeah.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick question. Have there been any farmers that have elected to go through track one?
There are. We have so far, not relatively many. The first couple, we have so far 14.
14.
So the first couple of responsibility areas that were up and due, there were limited numbers of growers So we actually have a deadline. Well, no. For the ones that have been notified, they've already had to make that decision. So most of them are going track two. But we have had about, four, I think, 14 was the count I had.
Thank you.
Any questions? Vice Chair Ashton, questions at this time?
No, I'll just echo the comments that I love the office hours and really appreciate our staff doing that. I think that that's incredibly helpful and shows our dedication to the community. So thank you.
Okay. It's worked out really well, and Farm Bureau has been very gracious to turn over their conference room when we show up and give us free rein. So we are looking to see if we can maybe find some other locations just because it's a large county and there are growers that are a bit of a ways from the office. So if we can get someplace closer, to some of the more eastern growers and parcels, then we'd like to expand it to other locations as well.
Well, thank you for your work on this and for your presentation. So that, I think three questions for you. Regarding L.A., you said that the trigger for Los Angeles has not occurred, but you didn't say when it would occur. So can you tell us?
That's based on their monitoring. And so far, there is no delay in terms of when it could trigger. It's just a matter of their annual monitoring has not yet shown exceedances of the TMDLs.
Okay. But in terms of the monitoring for L.A., all of that has been turned on time?
No problems with that.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you for that. And then secondly, you made mention of pursuing or we'll say bolstering implementation efforts and enforcement efforts. What did you mean by enforcement efforts?
Well, the big thing that we've heard from the growers is they'd like to see more enforcement of those that aren't participating. That I anticipate will be our focus is those growers that haven't been productive and active members of the program. So that is where we're going to focus those efforts first.
Right. Yeah, because we need to have an even playing field for those who are, complying. So just in your mind, what kind of percentage do you think of growers are either don't know, don't care? How many of them are not part of the program?
I don't have the numbers, but I would say most of the growers that I deal with the growers that are actively involved. Mm-hmm. So, and some of them don't want to be involved, but they still are doing their part. There is a list, and I don't have the numbers for you right now, of some operations that have been contacted multiple times to do their part and to enroll and have been given legal notices on this. And so that is where we're looking to focus those efforts. This is not just a LA region problem. I had a conversation recently with staff out in Region 7, and they've had, I would say, more hesitancy to enroll than we have. And so we were discussing more of an aligned strategy and tips in terms of like how to best move forward on this. A lot of the last 2 years we've been working on these new requirements. We've gotten them in place, and so and we're short staffed. We're now staffed up, so we're going to work on those efforts. I don't have the numbers though.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I would just say that enforcement, for those who are truly just recalcitrant, it's so important because it's otherwise it's really unfair to those who are making the effort to do the right thing. Now, in terms of the growers that have opted for track one, mm-hmm. Can they be defined as a certain group? Are they the larger growers? Are they more resourced? Are they?
I would say I haven't looked into it in depth in that way, but in having looked at the plans coming in and having talked to the growers as they were making those decisions, it really depend. or depends. It depends on what they've done in the past, if they've done a lot of work already. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple big growers we talked to who had. They're like, you know, we've spent the last 20 years developing a plan to furrow and flood fields. We've put in barriers, things like that. We've redone our capture and our drainage. We don't think we have anything more, so we want to show it. We had some growers who were like, well, I went out in the middle of the night before I had to make the decision, and it was raining, and I didn't see anything coming off the property, so I'm going to roll the dice, and I'm going to go for it. Mm-hmm. So it's across the board.
Okay.
I would say the bigger operations, I think, are mostly, I would say, are going track two.
Oh, they are?
They are. I think
that's interesting.
Without having the numbers for you, I would say they're probably going more towards track two when I'm looking at what's coming in.
Okay. And then our order, our 2023 order, I know that there was a whole process under that order of monitoring and track one and track two and so on. But is there compliance under that order, the requirements of it?
Yes, it seems, you know, we're still early in the track one, track two because of there were some data steps that had to be taken before we could tell who it applied to. So we're still early, but we're seeing really good response. We're a really broad response and compliance with it. We're seeing a lot of growers who are actively reaching out to us, both in office hours, email, calls, and, you know, we are hearing from the RCD and NRCS before the shutdown. We were hearing from them that, you know, they've got a list of people who have asked for technical service mm-hmm. assistance. Yeah. You know, we're hearing that from consultants as well. So there seems to be, well, they don't like it, and we sometimes hear about that. They do, in general, it seems like it's working. It's in, growers are in compliance.
Right, I understand. With the exception of what we'll call the recalcitrant group,
yeah.
who may not have sufficient information about this, that possibility too. So
I would say the ones that aren't enrolled fall under two groups. There's a group that maybe somehow over the last 20 years is unaware of the permit and the regulations. But what I would refer to as recalcitrant are the ones that have been notified and are not doing...
Correct.
Are not, yeah.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Understood. Thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation. Thanks for all your work on this. And I think that so now we will hear from Jody Switzer first.
Yeah, I have one slide to introduce them.
Okay.
And then they have their presentation.
Sure.
Yes, please. Sorry. It's just the last one. Yep, that's it. Thank you. So this is the same list of requirements I showed earlier in my presentation, and while many of the program requirements are conducted by the discharger group on behalf of their members, some of the components must be partially or fully completed by member growers themselves. And I've highlighted these tasks on slide. To help their members accomplish these tasks, VCALC has commissioned a new member portal that tracks farm and compliance information. They have a presentation to share a look at this new portal. So I'm going to turn it over to Jody Switzer, the Water Program Director for VCALC. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, good morning. Chair DeHaan, members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As Elisha said, my name is Jody Switzer. I'm the Water Program Director with the Farm Bureau of Ventura County. And I'm really proud to be able to share with you. Oh, sorry, I think I've got slides. Thank you so much. I'm really proud to be able to share with you a tool that we've developed called Clearwater, which is a centralized compliance communication portal for members of the Ventura County Agricultural Irrigated Lands Group, or VCALG. Clearwater has fundamentally changed how we manage grower compliance and communication under the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. And today I'll give you a quick tour of how it works and why it was needed. Next slide, please. So to speak first to the scale of the need, in Ventura County, VCALG enrollment includes nearly 1,400 individual landowners and growers operating about 3,000 parcels that cover more than 80,000 irrigated acres of crop production. And that's a huge and diverse membership base with operations as small as half-acre ranchettes with backyard orchards to as large as operations that have many hundred acres spanning across the county throughout multiple ranches. And the new ag order that took effect in September of 2023, growers were faced with a series of new reporting and TMDL-driven requirements. But the challenge wasn't just that there were new requirements. It was that these requirements varied depending on where you farmed, the water quality conditions at your representative monitoring site, and which TMDL compliance track the landowner and grower selected. And this introduced a level of complexity that challenged how we communicate requirements to growers. The new ag order also shifted responsibilities, moving many compliance tasks that had previously been implemented through VCALG to the individual landowners or growers themselves. We realized early on that we needed a tool that could clearly communicate what each enrollee needed to do and when, direct users to the right resources, and streamline VCALG's internal processes so that our team could focus more time on outreach, education, and technical support. And with these needs and considerations in mind, we immediately got to work when the ag order was adopted and brought on Provost and Pritchard Consulting Group to design and build Clearwater. Next slide, please. So to begin our tour, enrollees access Clearwater through a secure login page using their VCALG ID number and a unique password, and each account is tied to their specific parcels and compliance responsibilities. So once they log in, they see exactly what applies to them. Next slide, please. And this is the dashboard, which is the first screen that you see after logging in. From here, users can update contact information, add multiple email addresses, and make sure that important program communications reach the right people. And looking ahead, we're developing a compliance journey tracker that will visually show each enrollee their compliance status, so what's completed, what's due, and what's coming down the pipe. It'll also allow landowners who have delegated responsibilities to growers to monitor that those delegated tasks are being completed. And to the right of the dashboard tab, you'll see more tabs for partners, parcels, billing, and TMDL. And I'm going to walk through each of those modules in order now. Next slide, please. So starting first with the partners tab, in Ventura County, it's very common that the landowner isn't the grower actually operating the land. To account for that, Clearwater includes a partners tab where users can add people and businesses that they work with, so leasee growers, farm management companies, bookkeepers, etc. And soon we'll be adding a data reporter role to allow for certified crop advisors or other representatives to enter nitrogen reporting data for the irrigation and nutrient management reports. This functionality is critical because about 40% of the irrigated acres in Ventura County are leased, often on short-term or rotating bases. And landowners remain ultimately responsible for compliance, so they must delegate roles to their partners. And that delegation has to be mutually accepted by the partner on the other end because there are responsibilities that come with each role. And this was built to be a system that helps mirror how agriculture really works on the ground. Next slide, please. So moving over to the parcels tab now, this module displays all enrolled parcels for this user in both a list format as well as on a map. And this map feature has been a game changer. Growers don't think in terms of assessor parcel numbers or APNs. They think in terms of ranches or fields. So being able to see their parcels spatially presented on a map helps them identify what's enrolled and what might be missing. Next slide, please. So when you click on any individual parcel, Clearwater zooms into that parcel and it displays key details, including the APN, the ranch name for easy identification, the irrigated acres, the assigned responsibility area, and the enrollment status of that parcel. And if the irrigated acres for a parcel changes, the grower is empowered to log into Clearwater and make that change themselves as needed so that their enrollment stays up to date. You'll also see subtabs for partner delegations and farm evaluations, which I'll walk through next. Next slide, please. So this is the partner delegation subtab, which shows which partners have been assigned as the grower or billing party role for each individual parcel. And while landowner roles can only be changed by VCalg, based on county assessor data of who actually owns that land, grower and billing assignments can be delegated and updated directly by the landowner themselves through Clearwater. So the landowner logs in, they select the parcel for which they want to assign or change a role delegation, and then they choose from a drop-down that is pre-populated from their partner library. Next slide, please. And the last sub-tab under the parcels module is the farm evaluation survey, which is only viewable on grower accounts, and this is because it includes management practice questions that only the operator of the land would know. This is a survey that is required to be completed every 3 years to inform VCalg's water quality management plan updates. And the sections of the survey are represented by icons under each APN on the parcel list, because the survey has to be done on the parcel level. And when a section of that survey is completed, the corresponding icon will turn red or green. For example, the top APN on this list has completed the first two sections of the survey, which you can see in green, but still needs to complete the remaining 6 sections, and that's why those are still showing in red. When all icons turn green, the parcel survey is complete, and it's a simple visual cue that helps growers quickly see their status of completion. Next slide, please. So moving on to the next module is the billing tab, and this integrates program assessment billing directly into the platform, replacing old paper invoicing process. Users can view and pay their invoice online with per acreage charges broken out by responsibility area, reflecting the specific TMDL monitoring needs in the area. This functionality eliminates the manual processing of and receiving paper checks for over 1,000 invoices per year, freeing up VCalg administrative time to focus on program development and grower support. Next slide, please. And the last, but certainly not least, module to review is the TMDL module. So this is where growers can see, all in one place, what TMDLs apply to them, what actions are required, and how to complete those actions. So before diving into this module's features, I want to briefly walk through why TMDL compliance is so complex and why having this dynamic tool is so important. Next slide, please. So throughout Ventura County, there are multiple overlapping TMDLs. Elisha spoke to many of those. Many of these TMDLs apply to different subwatersheds and can create a layering effect where a different combination of TMDLs can apply in different areas. To illustrate this, I wanted to quickly review the spatial boundaries of the Cayugas Creek TMDLs over a series of maps. So first, we start with 3 TMDLs that apply throughout the entire watershed. And this is the Cayugas Creek Nitrogen Compounds TMDL, the Toxicity Chlorpyrifos and Diazinon TMDL, and the Organochloride Pesticide and PCB TMDL. Next slide, please. Then we layer on top of that the Salts TMDL. Next slide. Layering on top of that the Metals and Selenium TMDL, which does apply watershed-wide, but we only have load allocations for these 3 subwatersheds that are identified in green. Next slide. Then outlined in red here is the Oxnard Drain number 3, Pesticide PCB and Sediment Toxicity TMDL. And next slide. And then outlined in yellow is the Rivlon Slough and Beardsley Wash Trash TMDL. So we have this kind of layering effect of TMDLs which may have different load allocations for different sub-watersheds as well. Next slide, please. So to manage the effects of this layering, we've divided areas into responsibility areas, or what we call in shorthand, RAs. Each RA shares the same subset of applicable TMDLs and load allocations in the same representative monitoring site where compliance is evaluated. When a load allocation is exceeded at a representative monitoring site, that exceedance is considered representative of every parcel within that encompassing RA. And discharge limitations are then triggered for all parcels for that exceeding constituent. This framework simplifies compliance evaluation, but it also means that growers may have multiple ranches subject to different discharge limitations and deadlines depending on their responsibility area. So here's an example to consider. Let's say a grower operates 5 ranches in 4 separate responsibility areas. Each responsibility area has a different set of TMDLs, and compliance is evaluated at a different monitoring site. So that grower now has to track which ranches are in an RA where exceedances have triggered discharge limitations, which constituents exceeded in those RAs, the Track 2 management practice plan deadlines for each RAs, because these are phased in by RA, and any new exceedances that may occur later, which may build on an initial discharge limitation notification that was received for a different TMDL or constituent. So you can see how quickly this gets complicated, particularly for larger growers who operate in multiple areas throughout the county. But Clearwater was built to untangle this complexity and give growers clear, actionable information. Next slide, please. So jumping into the TMDL module, when a TMDL load allocation is exceeded, and the regional board staff confirm that, VCOG sends a discharge limitation notice to the landowner and growers of all affected parcels. Clearwater then flags those parcels in the system, and landowner and growers are directed to log in, review their information, and select a compliance track. So step one of this process, which is the NOI, or Notice of Intent, selection step, includes their account contact information, which is pulled from their dashboard screen, and then directs the relevant TMDL, and then displays the relevant TMDL information, which includes the TMDL name and the constituent that exceeded at the representative site, the parcels in the encompassing responsibility area, and the dates that those notifications were sent to the landowner and grower. And this notification date is very important because it begins a compliance clock for the next steps that I'll outline. So one thing I wanted to note is that in this example here on the screen, and I recognize that the font is a little small, but you might notice that one parcel is repeated twice because it's in a responsibility area that has triggered discharge limitations for constituents that are covered by 2 separate TMDLs. For example, maybe their monitoring site exceeded for both nitrate and chlorpyrifos. So they've triggered both the nitrogen compounds TMDL and the toxicity TMDL. Next slide, please. So scrolling down, but still on this step one NOI selection page, users select their compliance track for each parcel. So track 1 or track 2. Parcels are grouped by the landowner entity because the NOI must be signed by the landowner, as it is a compliance decision that stays with the parcel even after that grower might move on. If a landowner isn't in good compliance standing, for example, they haven't completed the farm evaluation survey, the required CEUs, or enrolled all of their parcels that they own, then the Track 2 option is locked. This is only available for landowners in good compliance standing. And then it also allows them to resolve that any outstanding obligation to then open up that opportunity. So as an example of this, you'll see the parcel grouping on top only allows for track 1. That track 2 option is kind of grayed out there because one of the parcels that they own had that incomplete farm evaluation survey with those red icons. And since their parcels are not all in good standing, they are limited to track 1. The parcel grouping at the bottom, which is owned by a different landowner, shown here as John, whose parcels are in good standing. Track two is available for them to choose. And Clearwater is able to check through the compliance status of each landowner on the fly and update eligibility in real time, allowing landowners to resolve any compliance deficiencies and be eligible for track two. So once all track selections are made, the user would confirm their selections and move on to step two, NOI submission. Next slide, please. So Clearwater then auto-generates the NOI for them, which is pre-filled with contact information, parcel and TMDL information, track selection, and their compliance status. Each NOI generated corresponds to one landowner entity and track combination. So large operators may have a dozen or more NOIs to submit because they operate on land owned by multiple different landowners. The NOI submission step shows each generated form, the applicable track selected, and the NOI submission deadline. So that's when it's due to be submitted to the regional board. Users can then download the completed NOI, have it signed by the landowner, and then upload it back into Clearwater for record keeping. These NOIs do still need to be submitted directly to the regional board, but Clearwater makes the process much more organized and transparent and provides a record for both landowners and growers. Next slide, please. So here's what a completed NOI looks like. This auto-filled format ensures that forms are filled out correctly and completely, and maybe even more importantly, legibly, which is hopefully much appreciated by your staff who has to receive and then process this information. Next slide, please. So when you expand each NOI row, you'll additionally see the parcels that were included on that NOI. You'll see the TMDL and constituents that the Track 1 or Track 2 plans must address, and the corresponding deadline for that Track 1 or Track 2 plan. Next slide, please. So now that the discharge limitations that have triggered for each parcel have been shown to the user, a compliance track selection has been made, and the NOI has been generated and submitted to the regional board, the final step in Clearwater is to develop and submit the Track 1 or Track 2 plan by the applicable deadline. The plan upload step here shows a plan deadline table, which is organized by track selection, so track one or track two, and plan deadline. So here you can see three rows of plan deadlines. The first for the two parcels that are complying through track one, and the remaining two rows for the parcels that are complying through track two. These track two parcels have different deadlines because they are located in different responsibility areas. In addition to displaying the plan deadline, users can upload their completed plans directly to their Clearwater account, keeping everything stored in one place for easy reference. Next slide, please. So that brings me to the end of the tour of Clearwater's current functionality, but we're not stopping there. We're actively developing new modules, including an INMR module for irrigation and nutrient management reporting, which will be due annually for growers beginning March of next year, a continuing education module to track CEUs, provide on-demand learning videos, including Spanish language content, and the compliance journey, which will be a visual roadmap of each member's requirements and completion status. We're really excited about how these tools continue to make compliance more understandable, accessible, and achievable. Because when growers understand what they need to do, when they need to do it, and how, that's when we create the conditions for real, measurable progress on water quality. So thank you again for inviting me here to share this overview, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Questions from the board? Okay, why don't we start with Board Member Camacho.
Just many congratulations on this tool. I mean, it looks very functional, easy to use, good user interface, and a lot of data in it, and it looks like there's going to be efficiencies to be gained in the reporting or administrative process. So I was wondering what percent of per- percentage of participation from the growers do you have that are currently wanting to use the tool or in there? And I just wanted to also know what type of how confidential is the tool? Because there could be a lot of sensitive information, sensitive contracts that are and relationships that are on there. And so I'm wondering how you deal with that.
Great questions. So to speak first to the first question about how many growers are utilizing this tool, the majority of VCalc members are. And even folks who might be less computer savvy, you know, we have spent time on the phone with them, invited them into our office to walk them through the system. We provide informational videos kind of step-by-step on YouTube to say, here's how you access your account, here's the click-by-click process to get to where you need to go, and try to provide as many resources to folks and make this as easy and user-friendly as possible. And really thinking through that user experience as we're developing Clearwater. So we're bringing growers into the process to weigh in on how to develop these new modules as we're building them out to say, does this make sense to you in a way that a grower really use and interact with this system? And as far as data confidentiality, so we saw that login screen, so it is user specific. They're logging in, they have their unique password. The information that we then have to pull down from Clearwater and report to the regional board through our annual reporting is the same as it's always been. So general enrollment information, the completion of their farm evaluation survey, the irrigation and nutrient management reports, when those are due, are all things that we let people know that you're entering this into Clearwater. This is something that we're going to have to report to the regional board. Some of it will be anonymized and some not, depending on the requirements of the ag order. And then as far as user interaction and the partners that are linked to accounts and data sharing within linked parcels, we've thought through that for there's certain information that growers might want to keep confidential from their primary grower on a parcel. So if they are a subtenant who's growing for a particular season or a portion of the parcel, they might not want the primary leaseholder to see their harvest yield information or their nutrient management program, which is proprietary to their operation. So we do have, as we're building out this INMR module, have thought through an option to make certain more sensitive information confidential to those linked users.
Yeah, and I was also wondering, you know, how the tool deals with change as well, because I recently noticed on Santa Rosa Road, there's significant acreage that has been, I guess, bought out by a developer and is going to be converted into luxury homes. And so how does that information work into this tool, those changes, and how does it then affect the responsibility areas and the monitoring locations as well?
Great question. So as far as land that has been taken out of agricultural production and has been converted to an entirely different land use, those folks would simply apply for a notice of termination through the regional board to take that permit out of the program. So it would no longer be enrolled in VCalg or need to comply through the ag order. But with respect to the monitoring locations, these are representative sites that are representing a larger area, but there is a drainage area that is going directly to them. And if there is significant land conversion in that drainage area, that might be something that we would want to consider if it would be justified to consider a different monitoring location that would be only characterizing agricultural drainage if that land use were to change. In that case, we would likely revise our monitoring and reporting plan and then change a monitoring location to find a more suitable representative site.
Yeah, because there could be construction activities that could adversely affect it and provide different types of constituents that are not anticipated by that responsibility area.
Yeah. Or fires. We've had a lot of those in the area, so we have to make sure to include all of that in our annual monitoring reports for other considerations of activities that happen or natural disasters that happen in the area draining to our monitoring sites that could affect results.
So it sounds like you have some a direct communication to the regional board in terms of those changes that occur and that you could then incorporate it into your tool.
Yeah, and I really want to commend your staff for being very readily available. As Elisha said, you know, we meet monthly at a minimum with them, open communication all the time, and they make themselves very available to both VCalg to, you know, for all of us to succeed at implementing this requirement and this ag order, but also to growers themselves.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And Board Member Christensen, anything from you? Okay. Board Member Mendez.
Yes, just a quick question. Again, along with Board Member Camacho, I'd like to congratulate you on this amazing work, and it's exciting to see this website and modules rolled out. The question, so is this entirely original to your organization, and if so, are you intend to license it to other farm bureaus and other regions in the state?
That is a great question. So this was built by Provost and Pritchard Consulting Group. They own the software for it. We license it from them.
Okay.
So, yep, they could license it to other coalitions throughout the state as well.
Okay. Well, hopefully that happens. It seems like a great tool for other regions to learn and adapt to their own specific needs.
Definitely.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ashton?
Just echoing the comments made earlier that thank you for developing this and for working on it and for ensuring that it's accessible and easy for those to comply so that we have safer water. So thank you. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Thanks. You said at the very beginning of your presentation that there are 1,400 growers. So.
Yeah.
How many of them how many of them are using this tool? Can you tell us that?
So almost entirely every one of them has to use the tool for their farm evaluation surveys that we did last year. So that's a requirement that applies to everybody. It's done every 3 years. So everybody needed to log into Clearwater, enter their responses to those surveys to talk about what management practices they're implementing on their parcels. We did have a handful who, you know, weren't able to use the tool. In those cases, we either took a few calls over the phone or we had them come into our office. So we are providing the support, but also really encouraging people to use this tool, knowing that it's going to have benefits going forward, in addition to just, you know, the surveys that people are used to doing on a reoccurring basis. But these TMDL-driven requirements, which can get very complex. So the benefit of using Clearwater to help clarify those dates for folks is going to be really critical. So at this point, we've only issued discharge limitation notifications to about 400 landowners and growers in responsibility areas where there have been exceedances. So those notifications went out earlier this year. They're on the compliance pathway, submitting their notice of intents, developing their management practice plans, or their monitoring reporting plans if they chose Track 1. And those are probably our more heavy users because they have more need to get into the system. But we also have a lot of people using it for billing purposes. So they're in there, they're paying their annual VCAG assessments to support the program, they're updating their parcel information.
That's great. So the vast majority of the 1,400 have used this tool, have filled out the information, and have provided it. That's a good step in a good direction, I think. So, all right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your presentation, and we'll hope to see you again here in news with more progress.
Yeah, happy to report on these modules that we're working on right now at a later date. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. All right. I have Al Sexton of the City of Simi Valley with available if needed for questions. I don't think we have any questions for me. Okay. So then with that, I think we're going to end our public session and adjourn into closed session. So I will ask our legal counsel to announce the items that will be discussed during closed session, and then we will recess for closed session and we'll return if need be. So would you...
Sorry. We're going to go into closed session for item 12K, People of the State of California, ex rel, California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Los Angeles Region versus Prologis et al. And that's it.
All right, thank you. Okay, so we're adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.